From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. What do you need in order to vote? You have to be at least 18 and a citizen of the United States. You have to be registered. And now, depending on where you live, you may have to show a government ID. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld an Indiana law that requires voters to show a government-issued photo identification before casting a ballot. Supporters say the law will prevent voter fraud. Critics say it will force some poor, rural, and elderly voters out of the election process. For more, we have Sherilyn Ifill, civil rights lawyer and law professor at the University of Maryland Law School, and Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators and former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Hi, folks.
Hi.
Hi, Farai.
So some folks say that these ID requirements prevent voter fraud. Sherilyn, how much evidence is there of widespread voter fraud?
None. It's a very simple question to answer. And you see it in the opinion. It's one of the most glaring aspects of the opinion. And that is that the state of Indiana was unable to present any evidence of widespread voting fraud, certainly widespread voting fraud as it relates to, you know, showing up on election day and pretending to be somebody that you're not, which is what this photo ID law is purportedly designed to address. In fact, the Supreme Court was only able to identify one instance, not even in the state of Indiana, I think in an election in Washington State, in which it had been documented that such voter fraud had occurred. There are other kinds of voter fraud related to absentee voting and so forth that have been documented, but those are not the kinds of voting fraud that would have been addressed by the photo ID requirement at issue in the Crawford case. There really wasn't any evidence.
Now, I'm going to get to you in a second, Ron, but Sherilyn, it seems most of us use government issued photo IDs all the time for any number of things in our lives, whether it's showing ID to sign a check at a store, traveling by plane if we do that, you know, driver's licenses. Why is this burdensome if it is? I mean, it sounds on the surface like it wouldn't pose a problem.
This may sound like a stretch, Farai, but I'm going to make the analogy anyway. It's almost like when people ask the question, you know, prior to Hurricane Katrina, why didn't people leave? For those of us who live, you know, fairly organized middle-class lives, these kinds of requirements are not going to be onerous or burdensome. You know, we would have packed up the car, gone to the ATM, gotten some money, and left New Orleans. We will have a photo, a government-issued photo ID. But for people who are poor, for people who are rural individuals, for the elderly, particularly elderly people who were born out of state and therefore don't necessarily have their birth certificate, for people who are leading more disorganized lives because of their socioeconomic condition, these things are burdensome. And what the Supreme Court showed in their opinion is something I think we're seeing consistently with this court, which is a real inability to relate to the lives, the way people live at the margins rather than at the center.
Ron, how do you parse out the court's decision and, you know, vis-a-vis people who may not have a lot of opportunity?
Wow, Farai, just listening to the professor's comments there, I have so much to say. I don't know where to begin. I think it's one of the most sacred privileges, not a right, but a privilege to be able to exercise the right to vote in the United States of America. The question that was presented to the Supreme Court was whether or not this was an overly burdensome or an onerous provision requiring individuals to come out with a government-issued identification card in order to vote. One of the important things in looking at the opinion, of course, is the fact that it is very, very interesting to note that one of the arguments that was presented was, well, you know, this is going to keep people of lower income, socioeconomic status away, and they're not going to be able to afford a government ID card. Well, the state of Indiana said that if you're not of social means to be able to afford it, we'll provide it for you. Well, it's going to be confusing for people who might be elderly, or it might lead to disenfranchisement. I think that's ridiculous. One of the things that's important to keep in mind also is the fact that to enter a government building, you have to show an ID, as you pointed out, to go to the airport, to function in American society. Most individuals have a government-issued ID. And again, the question is presented is whether or not that is an overly onerous or burdensome requirement, and 6-3. And John Paul Stevens, a very, very stalwart liberal lion, if you will, wrote the majority opinion, not someone who I would say is necessarily out of touch with American society. So to suggest that a 6-3 decision by the Supreme Court denotes that they're out of touch on this very minor provision, I think, is very, very misleading. And it's a privilege to vote in this country. And if the state of Indiana wants to have that requirement, there's no problem as long as you can prove that it's not overly burdensome.
Farai, let me just correct two things. One, One is it's a right to vote in the United States.
No, it is a privilege to vote. You can have that. You can have that right taken away if you're incarcerated. It's a privilege to vote.
All right, guys.
The right to vote can be burdened when the state can show that it has a justification, a rational justification, a legitimate justification, and many would suggest a compelling justification to burden that right. That's why we've eliminated things, and the Supreme Court's eliminated things like the poll tax. Because the first question we ask is, does the state have a justification? And therefore, the first question that should be asked is the question that Farai asked first, and that is, what is the justification? What is the evidence of widespread voter fraud? And there isn't any. And it seems to me that's the focus of the case. And once you answered the question, no, the state does not have a sufficient justification to burden the right, then there's no need to go any further into the questions that you're answering. And I think I already, you know, suggested that, again, if we're talking about, you know, average middle-class people who actually go to airports and enter government buildings to go to meetings, then of course they have a driver's
license. Let me get Ron back in here.
We're talking about.
Ron, is there a chance? I mean, we are practically on the eve of the Indiana Democratic primary. Do you think there's a chance that this decision will affect people who, you know, again, people who may be rural and elderly, who may not have heard about the Supreme Court decision? Is this all of a sudden going to affect people who are going to show up and try to vote in that primary?
No, because it's my understanding that those individuals who will go to the polls next Tuesday for this pivotal election, if they don't have that identification card, they can still vote and have a provisional ballot cast and then have an opportunity later to produce that government ID. So to suggest that people are going to be held away from the polls or not able to vote, I think is specious on its face. And let me say something else, Farai, as it pertains to the Supreme Court case. The Chief Justice of the United States signed a concurrence opinion that suggested that if, in fact, there was evidence that there was a burden, or if there was evidence that it would be overly restrictive, then the Supreme Court could adopt their most severe level of scrutiny, which is called strict scrutiny, which determines whether or not there's a compelling government interest to get involved. So to suggest that, well, this case is going to be somehow akin to the poll tax or it's going to keep people away, the Chief Justice left open the very real possibility that if, in fact, someone can return to the Supreme Court and prove that there is evidence that people are being held away from the polls or not being able to exercise the right to vote, then the Supreme Court could address that through strict scrutiny later. So again, this is a very narrow case. If there is evidence that it's keeping people away, the Supreme Court, in a concurring opinion, has already said how they would particularly deal with that situation.
Sherilyn, and I'm going to ask this both of you, what does this say about voting rights in America on a broader sense in terms of what the burden is on citizens to take responsibility for, you know, hitting certain benchmarks in order to vote? Is there a tightening, a general tightening of restrictions?
Oh, I think that if you read the three-justice dissent and actually also read it with the majority opinion or the three-justice plurality opinion, that I wonder how the Supreme Court would respond to the Harper versus Virginia Board of Elections poll tax case that was decided decades ago. I really wonder whether they would have struck down the poll tax. And I think we haven't, you know, touched on the great unsaid in this case, which is the partisan nature of this imposition on the right to vote. And there's no question that this whole illusion of voter fraud is something that's been pushed by Republicans in a number of jurisdictions and in a number of ways. And this is one of them. And the Supreme Court really does not address and seems unwilling to confront the ways in which there is this partisan manipulation of the right to vote. And until the Supreme Court's ready to take that on in an open and honest way, I think we're going to see more additional laws like the one in Indiana imposed to take advantage of what people think will be the partisan returns from discouraging certain segments of the population to vote.
This has nothing to do with partisan political politics or evil doing at play here. This has a very narrow application with the state of Indiana looking to determine whether or not it was overly restrictive or burdensome for people to produce a government identification. When you suggest that a 6-3 opinion authored by John Paul Stevens, one of the most liberal and one of the longest serving members of the Supreme Court, is A, out of touch, or B, somehow willing to roll back the rights of individual to exercise the right to vote, I think is not an accurate characterization. I am very, very concerned about the integrity of the ballot system, the election system, and if municipalities and states around the United States wish to ensure the integrity of the ballot system and the Supreme Court finds that legal, that should be the end of the discussion.
Before I let you guys wrap this up, looking ahead, do you think that this is going to have any impact on the general election? You seemed, Ron, to hint that there should be a great scrutiny of voting security. What do you think the impact of this will be on the general election, if any?
I think minimal. I don't see this playing out of disenfranchising or removing people's will or inclination or desire to vote because of what happened in Indiana. I think you're going to have a record turnout in this election, and in this case will not have any impact in minimizing that. I look forward to November.
Sherilyn?
Well, I think in Indiana, for those people who don't have that government-issued ID and for which it would be a burden to try and get one prior to the election, those people are likely not to vote. Ron mentioned the fact that you can vote with a provisional ballot, but then you have to, within 10 days of the election, show up at the circuit court to verify that you're the person who voted. And if we're talking about elderly people, if we're talking about people who live in rural communities, people who lack transportation, in the 21 counties in which there's not public transportation in the state of Indiana, then I think they are unlikely to vote.
Well, Sherilyn and Ron, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Sherilyn Ifill is a civil rights lawyer and law professor at the University of Maryland School of Law, and Ron Christie is vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators and former special assistant to President George W. Bush. He joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C.